faculty. You may be seated. Students come to court on our invitation under a national award-winning program called Court with Class. It's a program sponsored by the State Bar and this court. And they've been given materials about the case they are about to hear, and also may do some other activities relating to this case. And in addition to listening to oral argument, they will meet with one of the justices at lunch. There will be a discussion of the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues involved in the case. Everyone is invited to that discussion, even if you're not a student. Is there anyone in the courtroom who would like a summary of this case? We have copies of that. If you have.
Can we raise our hand?
Anyone else? All right. Having met you all, let me introduce the court to you. On my far right is Justice Patience Rogensack. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. He will be making the noon presentation with you. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left, Justice David Prosser, and on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. Having completed the introductions, we will now turn to our second case today, 03-AP-2968-CR, State v. Charles Young. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Young, is Assistant State Public Defender Martha Askins. Ms. Askins.
Good morning, Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court, my name is Martha Askins, and I represent the petitioner, Charles Young. The primary question presented today is when a seizure occurs for purposes of the Wisconsin Constitution. I'm asking the court to hold as follows. First, that Charles Young was seized at that moment when Officer Alfredson pulled his marked squad car up behind the car in which Young was a passenger, called into dispatch, turned on his flashing lights, and shined a spotlight into that car. Second, I'm asking the court to hold that the police lacked reasonable suspicion for a seizure at that moment in time. And third, as a result, the evidence which followed that moment in time, namely the marijuana, must be suppressed. I'm also asking, as the court knows from the briefs, to vacate the obstructing conviction.
Why?
Because the foundation of my argument is that that the officer lacked the lawful authority to make that stop at that moment in time. And because of that, everything that followed also, let me back up a minute. Because an element of the offense of obstructing is that the officer act with lawful authority. So without the lawful authority, Mr. Young cannot be convicted of the obstructing.
How does this fit in with our Kelsey case, which we did it in 2001, which, at least in my opinion, or from what it looks like, they adopted the Hodari rule as far as seizure is concerned, and that's one question. Just fit this into what happened sequentially. The officer got out of his car, turned on his flashers, didn't turn on the red light. Mr. Young got out of the other car back seat, at least factually it says in a nonchalant way, at least the first two steps were, and then in a hurried or fast walk run went to the porch, and the officer repeatedly asked him to stop, get back in the car, and then did a, well, I won't say a chase, but it sounded like a chase. And that seems to be what Kelsey said would be accepted by this court.
Well, Kelsey does say that this court is adopting the Hodari D standard. I mean, that's in the decision. I think the fundamental part of Kelsey CR, however, is really that it's a community caretaker case. When I got the state's... Okay.
Isn't this, we talk about caretaker here, this was an area, if I can, I'm just going to take a look. This was an area where this particular officer had been patrolling for about 7 years because of recent complaints of beer bottles in yards, loud music, boisterous customers going to and from the couple of bars. And in the preliminary, he gave painted a picture of what was going on and how he was handling the complaint.
Right.
So when you mentioned community caretaker, this is, I thought, well, this sort of fell into the same category.
Actually, I would take the position this does not fall in the category of community caretaker. And if we look at the facts of Kelsey CR, they're very different. In Kelsey, of course, we're talking about a young girl who was sitting alone after dark, huddled up against a storefront with her hood up over her head. And the officer stated that he was, you know, concerned that she might be a runaway. Now, this, I would say, is not a community caretaker case because a community caretaker precludes the notion that the officer is ferreting out crime. And when we look at what the officer's motivation was for that seizure in this case, he wanted to check out what was going on. I think he mentioned, you know, the concerns in the neighborhood about drinking and narcotics. But I see that as a different type of scenario than community caretaker. I think he was suspicious of this activity in this car. I don't think he was concerned about the well-being of the individual sitting in that car. Now, I am not saying, my position does not require this court to overturn Kelsey CR. My position would require the court to limit Kelsey CR such that it effectively is a community caretaker case, and that the police action in that case was justified by the community caretaker function. Now, I wanted to add, the state, of course, provided the court with a submission. I think I received it Friday, and you probably received it that day as well, where the state stated that, of course, instructing the court regarding stare decisis and advising the court that it should be restricted by Kelsey CR. I did want to address that. I am aware, and of course this court is acutely aware, of the importance of stare decisis. This court doesn't lightly abandon precedent, and I don't lightly request it. But the state submission of Progressive Northern seemed to me to really not be new authority, because it relies so heavily on Johnson Controls, which this court had previously decided. And in thinking about that, I looked at what Lefebvre has to say about stare decisis. And what Lefebvre says is the doctrine of stare decisis has only a limited application in the field of constitutional law. This is so because, unlike erroneous decisions grounded on other sources of law, erroneous constitutional decisions cannot be corrected by statute, but require a constitutional amendment, which, of course, renders correction much more difficult. In the various areas of the law where stare decisis is most critical is going to be in areas of property and contract, which, of course, is what the court was addressing in Progressive Northern and in Johnson Controls. So I don't think that This Court needs to be reminded of the importance of stare decisis. I think that's obvious. I don't think that this Court needs to overturn Kelsey C.R. It simply needs to clarify that what really was going on in Kelsey C.R. was community caretaker. And I would add that the State submission of the reply brief in Kelsey C.R. prompted me to go back and look at the briefs originally in the Court of Appeals decision, and the briefs before this Court. And in the Court of Appeals decision in Kelsey C.R., if I read it accurately, I didn't see any mention of Hodari in that decision. The parties didn't litigate it that way. The first time Hodari was injected into the case was in the Respondent's brief before this Court.
Ms. Askins, do you think that when we look at stare decisis that there's a temporal aspect that we should be looking at as well? What I mean by that is, if we've got precedent that's 5 to 10 years old, should we be more concerned about overturning that precedent than precedent that might be 75 or 100 years old?
My sense is that the longer parties have relied and courts have relied on whatever the authority is, that suggests that the Court should be more wary of changing the rules midstream. But and interestingly, I think what Progressive Northern talks about is the interpretation of a statute, which of course is not what's involved here. What we're talking about is, when does a seizure occur? What does the police officer look for in deciding to make a stop? So it's really a very different situation from parties. For example, I just heard a little bit of the argument before mine where evidently contracts is the discussion. I mean, I would suppose that reliance on statutes and the case law for what the rules of those types of business transactions are going to be especially critical.
I just had one more question. In Hodari, and that this was a case, 1991, but the facts there were, I would say, if you want to argue this, but they were similar. There was a police car came up upon some use, and they had one of the use, and that was Mr. Hodari threw away a small rock, which was crack cocaine. There, the officer tackled him. This isn't quite, there was, I don't remember whether there was tackling here, but there was a scuffle. There was the jacket which contained the drugs, which was pulled off, and the officer was trying to handcuff. It seemed to me that we're talking about a show of authority. Certainly it seems reasonable that when the officer is yelling at the defendant to stop, and he didn't, and he went to that, there was certainly a show of authority. He obviously knew, we think he knew what the officer, that wasn't police officer, and that he was running away from the police officer. Is that unreasonable? They seem to say in Hodari it wasn't a violation of the Fourth Amendment, but he hadn't been seized within the Fourth Amendment, which is, Fourth would be Article 1, Section 11, would be the Wisconsin Constitution.
Right. Well, actually, there are a couple of factual differences between Young and Hodari that I think are important. One is, and as I argue in my brief, the show of authority that we're talking about in Young, in this case, is more significant than there was in Hodari. In Hodari, basically, if my reading of the facts in that case are, these kids see or youth see a police car and flee at the sight of the car. And that did not happen here. The police officer, of course, circled the block. Nobody fled. Nobody did anything. The police officer then pulled up behind my client, makes this what I consider to be a significant show of authority. Now, that's different from Hodari, and the reason that I think that's important is what I'm asking the Court to conclude is that a reasonable person would have believed he was seized at that moment. And that is, of course, the Mendenhall standard. And what I'd ask the Court to do is take the opportunity in this case to reaffirm the Mendenhall standard, that a person has been seized when, in view of all of the circumstances surrounding the incident, a reasonable person would have believed that he was not free to leave.
Yeah, now, the State argues that Mendenhall is not inconsistent with Haddari.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say that it seems to me that, and here you had a show of authority. As I read Haddari, they were dressed, they had big police on their uniform. And here this officer was dressed in a police uniform. And if you take the facts in our case, Mr. Young, in a, it said a nonchalant way, maybe there was some misunderstanding the first couple of steps, but certainly there wasn't when the officer is pursuing him, running after him, and Mr. Young is running in front of him trying to gain access to the porch of one of the residences. So in that sense, there was certainly a show of authority.
That's correct. And that's
and
why
there wasn't any, and the seizure didn't take place until he was apprehended.
That's the crux of the matter. My position is that the show of authority is the seizure. And what Haddari D is saying, it's not until we actually have our hands on this young man that he's seized because he hasn't submitted. My position is the correct view is to look at the moment of the show of authority, because that is the moment where we analyze what the police officer knew. And that's what's important for the Constitution.
And let me ask you about that, because you've asked us to look at this in view of the Wisconsin Constitution. But I want to take it back to the United States Constitution for a moment. As I read Haddari D and look at the subsequent case of Illinois versus Wardlaw,
right,
what you are dealing with is unprovoked flight from a police officer, correct?
Correct.
In this situation, we are not dealing, at least according to the briefs in Young, with unprovoked flight from police officers. You have first interference by a police officer, followed by flight. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, I understand that in our court, we may not have dicta, but I understand the United States Supreme Court does. And the case is limited to its facts. The holding is limited to its facts. Does Haddari D stand for the proposition that where you have unprovoked flight from police officers, that you are not seized until you either submit or until you are caught? Is that the holding of Haddari D?
I don't know that Haddari D turns on whether the flight is provoked or unprovoked. I think that what matters in Haddari D is that there is some signal from the officer, and then there's actual submission to that officer. So I don't know that unprovoked or provoked is necessarily the turning point for the holding of Haddari D. But what I take to be the holding is you have to actually submit to the authority before you are seized. In other words, it is the action of the citizen who controls when the seizure is, as opposed to the action of the police. And that's the focus that I think is important for the court to go back to, is to say, what did the police know at that moment when the police took this action?
What the police knew, and this is what you talked about, obstruction and how that should be knocked out.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to the facts here, it seems to me that there was no submission. There actually was, I would say, there was an apprehension. I mean, he grabbed, there was a struggle, there was apprehension, and at the time there was the apprehension, that's where the obstruction came. Isn't that true?
Right. I think where the resisting and the obstructing come in is the the attempt to, you know, get away from the officer, however you want to characterize it, the going up on the porch, and then I would assume that struggle that occurred on the porch where there was a little bit of sort of tussle over the jacket. So I think that's where those come in.
Counsel, I need clarification. I understood it to be that you were suggesting that the obstructing was the walking away, the resisting was the,
right,
the tussle, if you will, and that you are not challenging the resisting.
Well, let me clarify that. I did say that in my brief.
No wonder.
Yes, I did say that. And I, in rereading the Court of Appeals decision, I think maybe I was wrong. I think maybe both the resisting and the obstructing must fall because lawful authority is part of the elements of that offense. Now, I think where I was coming from with that was a concern out of the over the Hobson decision. But the elements of the crime of resisting, obstructing, and obstructing both have that lawful authority element. So I think I was wrong in my brief, and I think if my theory holds, both of those convictions have to be vacated.
I have a question about Kelsey. As I read the opinion, and I may have misread it, the part of the opinion adopting Hodari is only signed on by three justices. It's a minority opinion. It's a majority opinion for affirming the delinquency adjudication, but Hodari was not adopted by the a majority of this court. Do you read
in Kelsey?
In Kelsey, yes.
Kelsey.
And maybe it was adopted in another case, and I'm missing that, but at least in this case, it was not adopted. Justice Crooks wrote, Sykes and Prosser filed a concurring opinion that went on the grounds that when you invite somebody into the squad car, you can search them. And Bradley and Abrahamson dissented on the ground that there was no reasonable suspicion to do a Terry search. And Sykes and Pross agreed there was no reasonable grounds to do a Terry search, but they went on a different tack that there was another reason to do a reasonable search. So,
well,
That's
accurate. I think, and I think partly also that goes to the matter of really what the focus of Kelsey CR was. There was disagreement about the search before the squad car, but there really wasn't a lot of discussion about whether or not the police officer should have been talking to Kelsey in the first place. I think the parties started out with the proposition that it was okay for the police to be talking to her about her well-being, and that's different from this case.
You said that there was a seizure when they drew up, the card, squad card drew up, turned on its lights, shined the spotlight. That's the test for when it was the reasonable suspicion. I was surprised. Why didn't you say when the police officer said stop?
Because I think that the turning on a flashing lights and putting a spotlight into a car is a signal to all of us. It's unclear from the record exactly what was flashing. I think that the way I read it was it wasn't the rolling flashes.
Lights, right.
It was flashing lights, but that they were still on top of the car. That's how I read it. And then, of course, there's the spotlight. And to me, as a driver, I take that as stop right there. Do not go anywhere. And I think that's a universal sign that you are seized. So that's why I focus on that moment, Your Honor. I think certainly when the officer, if we didn't have that and the officer said, stop right there, then I would say that that was that moment.
Thank you.
May I ask, put yourself in the position of the officer driving the squad car. It's about midnight.
on October 26th. You have passed this vehicle that you see five people in, and you come back about 10 minutes later, give or take something. What do you believe the officer was entitled to do when he saw the car a second time with five people in it?
Well, he had a few options. And I would just note that, of course, we know from the trial testimony that this is a residential area. There is a residence that he obviously went up onto the porch of. Of course, the officer could continue to circle the block. There's no problem with that. The officer could have parked his car somewhere and walked up and down the street, looked into the car to say, hey, you know, what are you guys doing? Everything okay here? But to turn on the overhead flashers, to me, says, you know, in fact, the police officer even said, that's when I decided to stop the car. I mean, he wanted to seize this car and the people in it. So there were other things that he could have done, and maybe the easiest is to stop the car and go for a walk, you know, see what's going on in the neighborhood. And I would also add, we know from the trial transcript, as it turns out, there was a party at that house. And so there may have been other kids kind of walking around in the area. So that seems to me to be maybe a logical way of investigating what was happening.
Let me ask this. Suppose you're that same officer and you're out on the highway and you see a car at the side of the highway with a single driver in it. It's not operating, but it's midnight.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do, officer?
Well, then I'm thinking that's where the community caretaker concern maybe is at the forefront rather than the investigation of crime. Maybe at that point the officer is concerned that the person has fallen asleep or, you know, is hurt or what have you, or the car is broken down. And so then we go over to the community caretaker analysis, which precludes the ferreting out of crime. So then the officer, I think, can pull up and say everything okay here.
You don't think that officer might have suspected a little?
I guess I was thinking along the lines of, you know, on a highway that somebody maybe is in trouble. Waldner, of course, is the example of the, you know, drinking, or he's dumping the contents of his cup out of the door. And there, you know, the officer says, I've got reason to think that this guy is drinking and driving.
In the case we have, is there any dispute that four people within the car were seized?
Everybody in the car. And under my test, everybody in that car is seized at that moment. Is that your question?
Well, wouldn't your opposing counsel agree that at least four people were seized?
Are you making the distinction because four people sat in the car? Is that what you're saying? I don't know what opposing counsel's position would be. My position is five people were seized at that moment, four people who stayed in the car and my client, Mr. Young. Is that?
There's no ability to draw a distinction between people who submitted to a show of authority and one who did not?
No, and the reason I say that is that the focus of the Constitution, whether it's the Fourth Amendment or Article 1, Section 11, is on police conduct, not citizen conduct. It regulates police action, not our action. And so the heart of the matter is that when the police say, stop, everybody stopped, no matter how they respond. Otherwise, the fact that I don't submit makes the police officer's action lawful. Well, and that can't be right, it seems to me.
Let me ask this. Suppose I have been drinking rather heavily. I'm out on the highway. And I realize that I'm under the influence.
Okay.
So I pull up on the side of the road, and an officer pulls up behind me.
You're in trouble.
Concerned about concerned whether I'm all right.
Okay.
Can I get up and run away? I mean, stumble away.
Stumble away, right.
I want legal advice on this one.
Right. I believe that the Constitution gives us the right to walk away from an encounter with the police. And one of the things that this case, I think, invites the court to do
is that
delineate.
Walk or run?
Well, that's partly why I believe my test, the Mendenhall test,
does
is the
make
correct
a lot,
one.
In the real world, does that make a lot of sense?
It doesn't make sense, because when the courts get into the business of deciding whether it's a jog or a trot or, you know, whatever, then I think we're in trouble. Whereas if we focus on what did the police do, not how did the citizen respond, then we have something concrete that we can work with. So in answer to your question, Justice Prosser, one of the things that I would hope that the court would take the opportunity to do in this case is to articulate that we as citizens continue to have the right that was articulated in Royer, that we do have the right to walk away from an encounter like that. Now, if on a highway, maybe my answer would be modified somewhat. I'm thinking about a street encounter, but I guess I would still maintain that yes, you can walk away.
But the question really is, was there a seizure with the police car pulling up behind drunken Justice Prosser?
Notice how
it's
you
were
question.
There. Strike that, Chief. Well, no different
hypothetical. Okay, Justice Brooks.
We have a fungible group.
Right.
All right. So, car's on the side of the road. He's either pouring out liquor or he's just sitting there. The car has its lights on. The police car has blinkers on and shines a spotlight. I'm trying to put it in the fact situation here. If I understand you, then at that moment there's a seizure. It may be that this is a caretaker and that he's perfectly sober, as we might expect, but he has car trouble or he's just gotten tired. Or you go up to the car, the officer goes up to the car, Justice Prosser pulls down his window, and it reeks of an intoxicant,
mm-hmm.
right? Now you got reasonable suspicion at the time of the seizure, or is it too late then when you go to the car?
Police encounter commences as a community caretaker.
Yeah.
I think under your hypothetical, it commences as a community caretaker, and it changes at some point.
The seizure is okay because it's a caretaker function.
Right.
That's your position.
And
may change.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Askins. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Kleinmeier, Assistant Attorney General Kleinmeier.
May it please the Court, my name is Stephen Kleinmeier, Assistant Attorney General, representing the State of Wisconsin, the plaintiff respondent in this case. And the result the State is requesting the Court to reach is that it reaffirms Kelsey C.R.'s adoption of the Hodari D standard for seizure as a test for seizure under the Wisconsin Constitution, that it, and the facts of this case conclude that the show of authority was the officer's second command to the defendant to stop. To find that the seizure occurred when the officer grabbed or reached and touched the defendant on the porch of the house, and that the officer had reasonable suspicion by the time he made the seizure, and also that there was also, in terms of the obstruction conviction, that there was reasonable suspicion at the time he made the show of authority. Now,
what was the reasonable suspicion when he actually physically touched him?
Well, the two, there's at least by the time he got to him, there's four factors. The time of night in the area, which are significantly more in this case than some cases, because this area had the problems. They said at night there was the problems of the drinking in the area, and neighbors reported drinking in the cars, which is a violation of the law, which I cited in the statute, and of drug use. Then on top of that, he saw the car, five people sitting in the car, comes around 10 minutes later, sees five people still sitting in the car, and he said that was unusual to see five people still sitting in the car because normally someone has time to get out. And then there's also...
All those were in existence when he pulled up behind.
With the first show of authority, yes. Mm-hmm. And then, with the show of authority. Right. And then...
There's no seizure then, according to you.
Right.
Okay, so what triggers it when he's grabbed?
Well, the officer gets out of the car, and the defendant gets out of his car. The officer told him, first of all, stop, get back in the car. There was no response from the defendant. He kept walking. The officer said he acted like he didn't hear me. So I think we have to assume, for a show of authority, it has to be communicated to a person. So we have to assume the defendant didn't hear the first command. The officer yelled again, stop, get back in the car. This time the defendant turned, looked at him, and ran to the house. And it's that command that I'm saying is the show of authority in this case. The defendant's then running from the officer to the house is a flight under Wardlaw that also contributes to the reasonable suspicion by the time he grabs him at the house.
Mr. Kleinmeier, if I could, given the facts of this case where the police officer pulled up alongside of the vehicle, turned on some lights that were flashing, although not the overhead rollers, and shone the spotlight inside the vehicle. If, instead of getting out and walking away, if that car had been pulled away and sped away from the police officers, could the driver have been charged with fleeing an officer?
No, because the officer said he did not have his emergency lights on. And it's the emergency lights that trigger the requirement for the driver to stop. And that's why I say there was no show of authority with that. And also the car is, it's maybe a small point, but the police car was not alongside the car the defendant was in. It was behind. He said it was next to the car that was behind the defendant's car.
Could I ask the four other people in the car, is it your position they were not seized?
Correct. Because there was no command. He didn't yell at them to stop and get back in the car. And they all got out. Everybody in the car got out of the car. That's what at the trial, the woman who, Miss Johnson, who was in the car, testified that all she saw was a spotlight. She didn't hear any sirens, didn't see any other lights. And the defendant was the first guy out of the car, and he left, and then everyone else also got out of the car. They apparently stayed in the area, though, but they're not real clear exactly what they did, but they did all get out of the car.
Is this the same? Would this case be the same if, when the police officer yelled "stop," the defendant turned and walked away as opposed to run?
In terms of the question of, I think we have different aspects, several aspects to this. One is submission to authority. Whether walking away or running away is different in terms of submitting to the officer's show of authority. I think in terms of that, no, walking away is also not submission to authority. Both walking and running away would not be submission to authority. But in terms of how those could be used to add to reasonable suspicion, I think there's definitely a difference.
Well, the reason I ask is I'm looking at your brief on pages 25 and 26, and you cite to the Wardlaw case, which I think is the logical extension of Hodari D. And in Wardlaw, the court makes it perfectly clear that an individual with an absence of reasonable suspicion has a right to ignore the police and go about his business, but then goes on further and says, but running away is not the same thing as going about one's business. Running away provokes suspicion. What's wrong with that analysis?
Well, that analysis was saying to Royer, and the quote that they're trying to determine in Royer, the discussion in Royer was about when the court was setting up some general propositions before it addressed the specifics in Royer. And it's talked about confrontations, a consensual encounter between the police officer and a citizen in the street, where this officer comes up without reasonable suspicion or probable cause and, you know, says, may I ask you a question? And the person says, you know, I don't want to be bothered, and walks away. Well, there's nothing to draw from that. There's no reason for the person to have to stay. Now, in terms of when the officer makes a show of authority and tells someone to stop, well, that's no longer a consensual encounter. I mean, the officer is giving a command to stop. I don't think the person is really free to walk away in that situation, but saying that, you have to look in terms of the consequences if the person does walk away. And if the officer says, don't go, you know, stop, does not have reasonable suspicion, I'm not sure there's any consequences to the person starting to walk away. Under Wisconsin, if there's no lawful authority, they can't be charged with obstruction. And in terms of how the walking away could be used to provide additional evidence of reasonable suspicion, the running under Wardlaw and under Anderson, the Wisconsin Supreme Court decision, the running provides reasonable suspicion. Walking is much more ambiguous. I mean, you've walked away from an officer, that doesn't necessarily indicate that you're really trying to get away, because if you're walking, you know the officer can catch up and get you if he wants to, he or she wants to. So, I mean, there may be some circumstances where walking away would contribute to reasonable suspicion. I frankly haven't been able to think of them. But, I mean, since reasonable suspicion is based on totality of circumstances, there may be some situation where walking would.
The reason I ask you the question is because I think the thrust of your brief is that there has to be some submission. And I go back and I look at Brown versus Texas. And in Brown versus Texas, I'm not sure you had a submission. What you had is the police coming up to an individual absent reasonable suspicion, wanting to talk and wanting to identify himself under Texas law, and he refused. So there was no submission there. He refused to comply.
But I don't remember all the detail of that, but didn't he stay in the officer's presence to answer the question?
Oh, he didn't walk away. He didn't run. He didn't comply either. And that's why the compliance or the submission to the officer's authority, I'm not sure, is the turning point. That's the concern that I have, because there was no compliance in Brown either.
Well, he didn't ask.
In Brown, he didn't run.
But he stayed in the officer's presence, and I think that would mean by submission of authority for purposes of seizure. I don't think, you know, even under Terry, I don't think you have to answer the officer's questions. But you do have to stay there if it's a legitimate seizure. And so I think in that terms, it sounds like that case would then be a submission to authority by the fact he remained in the presence of the police. I do want to address a point raised by Chief Justice Abramson about the Kelsey C.R. case and the number of justices who joined in that adoption of Hodari. In the paragraph 3, which is, I think, pages 431 to 432, there's a footnote that the Court's summarizing its holdings and says, lastly, we hold the pat-down, I'm sorry, the majority opinion, we hold the pat-down search or frisk of Kelsey was reasonable. And then there's a footnote, footnote 1, four other members of this Court, Justices Babbage, Wilcox, Prosser, and Sykes, joined this conclusion. However, Justices Sykes and Prosser would hold that the pat-down was reasonable because the officers had the reason for justifying the pat-down. Then, when we get to Justice Sykes' opinion, which starts on page 457, it's paragraph 52, she says, I respectfully concur. I agree with the majority's two-part analysis of the stop in this case. However, I agree with the dissent's assessment of the frisk.
Right.
So I think in terms of the stop, the seizure, there are at least five justices who joined in adopting Hodari as the test for seizure.
Counsel, don't cite Hodari. The only one that cites Hodari, I think, is the lead opinion here.
Yes, and that's the one that was joined by five justices on that part of the opinion.
Counsel, you read paragraph 52, which is the first paragraph of the concurring opinion, but I always like to look at the last paragraph or paragraphs also, just because that's oftentimes where the punch is. And here you can see paragraph 70 and 71 are the last two paragraphs of the concurring opinion. And in relevant part, you have to read it, I guess, 70.
Kelsey, I'm starting with the second sentence of 70. Kelsey was a vulnerable 15-year-old girl who would have been at risk of harm if the police had left her alone at night in an unsafe neighborhood. Her wishes may or may not have coincided with her mother's, leaving it to Kelsey to decide whether she wanted the ride and the accompanying search would have violated her mother's request and better judgment and the statute's preference in this situation for returning juveniles to their parents. Paragraph 71, the last paragraph. There was, because of that, as I read it, there was an entirely reasonable and legal basis for this particular squad car ride. It was not a pretext to conduct an otherwise unreasonable search. Under these circumstances, and under this independent basis, and even absent a reasonable suspicion that Kelsey was armed and dangerous under Terry, I would find the officer's protective frisk for weapons constitutionally reasonable.
Yeah. But I don't want to see them. It's very hard. Excuse me, Justice Bradley, my good friend, and I don't think you answered the question, I hate to see the justices arguing back and forth on what a particular opinion meant, but I don't think there was anything that I saw that was read that is going to make a difference. That's
a fair point. Okay. Let me ask, though, counsel. From this in 70 and 71, I see the emphasis of the discussion as I read, vulnerable 15-year-old girl who didn't want to go necessarily home, but he was concerned about a runaway, and as Justice Sykes says, that who would have been at risk of harm if the police had left her alone at night in an unsafe neighborhood. Maybe it isn't clear. I don't know, but that's what's emphasized in 70.
Well, I think that's just justifying the frisk without reasonable suspicion.
But the argument, the reasonable suspicion of the pat-down is really what the tension was between the concurring opinion and the dissenting opinion, if I remember correctly.
And Justice Sykes' opinion notes that you didn't need reasonable suspicion to pat someone down when you put them in the car to transport them.
Under these circumstances, she was indeed the facts of this case. I mean, she was under these circumstances where you have this 15-year-old vulnerable. That's the first sentence. Under these circumstances, second sentence, vulnerable 15-year-old would have been at risk of harm if left alone. I mean, that's
the frisk at the end. The Hodari D was a seizure at the beginning. And I think at the beginning of Justice Sykes' opinion, she's agreeing with the two-part analysis of the stop. Hodari D goes to the stop. And so when she says she's agreeing in an opinion joined by Justice Prosser, in a concurrence joined by Justice Prosser, when they're saying that they're agreeing with the majority's two-part analysis of the stop, then I think that includes the Hodari D adoption, which was part of the justification or explaining the stop. Also, as to the use of stare decisis in a constitutional case, this court recently did just that in State versus DuBose, discussing overruling previous cases, and as a constitutional issue, footnote 9, citing Johnson Controls and the criteria there, and DuBose was used to overrule previous decisions because of newly ascertained facts, new studies and stuff on identification procedures. So I think those same criteria would apply in this case. And I don't think those criteria were satisfied in this case. I don't think the reason was given for overruling that holding in Kelsey C.R. I think that the court, even without Kelsey C.R., if we eliminate the we already have a decision that they have to be overruled, then you still have to be a discussion about whether we're going to interpret the Wisconsin Constitution differently from the Article 1, Section 11, differently from the Fourth Amendment. And there were several criteria for that. And again, I don't think any of those have been satisfied in this case to interpret it differently. We look at the text of the two provisions, and this court has said they're identical. You look at the protections afforded by the supervisions, and this court in Frye said that the Supreme Court doesn't provide any less protection than the Wisconsin. In other words, they provide the same protection. I think that's also buffered or supported by the history of the adoption of Article I, Section 11, where it was, the wording was changed to be the same as the Fourth Amendment, to provide, and the old text or the explanation was to use the words that conveyed the meaning most fully and is most generally used in constitutional law, so I think they were meant to be the same. Other policies in the state are the similar as the policies behind Hodari. That's where we cited the Hobson case. It's obviously not a constitutional question in Hobson, but the very eliminated the privilege of using force to resist an unlawful arrest, and the main part of the reason was to discourage self-help, because that could lead to violence, and to encourage citizens to seek redress through the legal process. And Hodari said that would be, that's a policy that's supported by his decision, because when an officer says stop, the citizen shouldn't be making the legal decision about whether it's justified or not. He should stop and challenge it in the court system.
Could I go back to previous question or previous subject matter? The officer is in the squad car, pulls up next to the subject car. You're saying that is not, and the lights are flashing. You're saying that is not a seizure with respect to the four people who either remained in the car or in the immediate area?
Well, Your Honor, there are two distinctions between this case and what you just said. He did not pull up next to the car. In other words, if he pulled up next to it, that would be blocking
him. I understand the facts of this case.
And he also said he did not turn the emergency lights on. It's the emergency lights which tell a driver that they have to stop in response to the police car. So he said he put on flashing lights because he stopped in the street and it's nighttime and he wants to give warning to the cars that there's a car parked in the street. But he should put his flashing lights on, but not the emergency lights.
Are those the flashers we all have? Is that what you're...
Well, that's not exactly curious. He talked about them being on the side. And he said the overhead rolling lights, and at one point he said the overhead rolling lights were not on, and he said the emergency lights were not on.
And my flashers are on, visualizing the side of the car so people could see them on either...
Yeah, side. I mean, he didn't say if it's on the side, the top of the car, on the side, at the rear, you know, on the bottom, like you think we picture with most cars. That's not entirely clear. But he did clearly say he did not have his emergency lights on.
Counsel, my understanding of how the police lights, the overheads work, correct me if I'm wrong, there's an overhead light that when they want somebody to step, they put it on and it rolls and you get the audible sound. But in addition to that, on top, it's also configured so that on the top of the vehicle, the lights can flash alternatively. Am I missing something? Am I wrong on that?
Well, that's the part about where it's not exactly clear when he said where the flashers were. But he did, there's a point, excuse me a second here.
If that matters, then this record is unclear. Is that right?
Well, he said that the this is on page 45, document 45, page 64. The officer said, "I put my flashers on. They blink on the sides. They don't have the overhead emergency rollers going all the way." Then later on, document 45, page 78, he said he had the flashers on. I didn't have the full emergency lights, just the flashers. So it's the emergency lights that's the key to telling people to stop. So without those being on...
Well, the reason I ask is because most citizens, if they were to see, I mean, looking from a citizen point of view, if you saw the overhead flashers on, I don't know about anybody else, but I would assume stop and wait.
Well, what you just said there, Justice Pedro, I think is a key. What you see, there's no evidence in this case that Mr. Young saw any of this. And the one witness in the car who testified was Ms. Johnson. She said she saw a spotlight, she didn't hear sirens, and she couldn't recall any other lights. So in other words, for a show of authority to, even under the Mendenhall test, if a show of authority constitutes a seizure, it still has to be communicated to the citizen. Here, there's no evidence that the citizens in that car ever saw any lights except a spotlight. And we've already cited two cases, which, by the way, they're from other jurisdictions, but they used the Mendenhall test, and even they said spotlights do not constitute show of authority and don't make for a seizure.
When would the defendant have seen that it was a police car and a policeman in an identifiable jacket?
The officer said he saw the defendant get out of the car. The officer yelled the first time or said something, stop, get back. There was no response. The defendant continued to walk, and that's when the officer said, it's like he didn't hear me. Then the officer yelled the second time, stop, get back in the car. He said at that point, the defendant turned, looked at him, and then ran.
Was he out of the car?
At that point, yes, the officer was out of the car. The officer said he got out. He both got out of the cars, the respective cars at the same time.
And this was a marked car which had overhead lights.
My recollection is, yes, it's a marked squad car. And so a lot of these facts go with my argument that the show of authority was when the second time the officer ordered the person back in the car, because that's the only time there's any evidence that the defendant was aware of the presence of the officer or that it was aware of any reason he was not free to leave or he was not supposed to leave. And at that point, then he ran, and under Hodari, there's no seizure because he didn't submit. He didn't stay with the officer. As I already mentioned about the spotlights, those are cases that doesn't constitute a show of authority that would lead to a seizure by themselves. Also, there was an argument made in the defendant's brief that he did momentarily submit because he didn't get out of the car immediately. Well, again, that goes back to the point about there's no evidence he even knew about the officer's presence at that point. And also a case cited in our brief, United States versus Valentine, 232 F3rd 350 on page 359, talks about momentary compliance or a momentary hesitation does not constitute submission to authority. And also, then we get to the question about reasonable suspicion, whether the officer had reasonable suspicion when he made the show of authority. Now, when he went through the four factors, I think showed clearly the flight, I think, showed reasonable suspicion by the time he actually grabbed him and made the seizure under what the state says was the seizure. There's also the question about the sufficiency of the evidence for the obstruction charge. And for that, the officer would need reasonable suspicion at the time he ordered the person to stop and get back in the car. And I think even the factors unknown to the officer at that point still gave him reasonable suspicion because it was a time of night when he had reports of people drinking in cars and drug activity in the area. And then he sees these five people sitting in the car, he sees them, comes back 5 to 10 minutes later, there's still five people in the car. Officer says, it's unusual for five people to stay in the car that long. They had time to get out of the car. And Amos, the Court of Appeals, pointed out that people normally get out of their cars. They don't stay in them. And then the fact that the officer thought it was unusual that the people stayed in the car, the unusual activity can also contribute to the reasonable suspicion.
Mr. Kleinmeier, if I can ask you about that, because maybe I just heard you wrong and I want to make sure I didn't. Did you just say that for the obstructing charge, the reasonable suspicion has to occur at the point when he says stop?
Well, that's when he ordered him to stay.
Right.
The second time when the defendant heard it.
Right.
The obstruction charge was based on the fact that he didn't stay and he left. So if he's going to be charged with obstruction for leaving, the officer had to have the lawful authority at the time he told him to stay. I mean,
So you don't take into account the fact that he ran. You have to look at the point before that running.
For the obstruction, the running was after the basis for the obstruction charge. The obstruction charge was the fact he did not immediately stay. That was the way I understood that the prosecutor to argue it. And that because, so that the, and then the running, yeah, that, then that, after, in other words, after, by leaving,
resisted.
He obstructed. The resisting was the struggle on the
so
porch.
The obstruction is the walking away. That's the way that I...
Well, walking or running, but leaving when the officer told him to stay.
Is there a difference between walking and running for purposes of the obstruction charge?
No, because in terms of the obstruction, no, because he's either way, he's not complying with the officer's order to stay, to stop. For that purpose, it doesn't make any difference if he walks or runs, because either way, he didn't stay where the officer told him to stay.
So
now, for that to be an obstruction, one of the elements is that the officer had lawful authority when he said it. And that's why, for that purpose, the officer needed reasonable suspicion at the point gave him the command to stop.
And the reasonable suspicion was?
The time, the area, and also he saw these people sitting in the car for 5 to 10 minutes. And he suspected, and that was consistent with drinking in the cars and drug use in the area. And he says it was unusual for people sitting in the cars that long. And that's, again, supported by the statement of the Amos case, that, you know, people, when they stop their cars, they typically get out of them. They don't sit in them. So, I mean, that case, I think, supports the officer.
Is it reasonable, then, if I am in a drug area and what's different from me being in that drug area at that time of night with four of my nephews? And we're sitting there talking about those backers. And the police come up, and it's that time of night, and so I get out of the car and I start walking away, and they say stop, and I think, stop? What's wrong? Here I am, okay, you know, I know the area, it's a bad area. We're just sitting here, stop, I'm walking, I'm leaving, I'm out of here. That's obstructing, huh?
Yeah, the additional factor was that in this case the officer went by twice, and he didn't just drive by the first time.
I just want to make sure that, you know, a fair-haired, or at once fair-haired, middle-aged lady who walks away, that it's the same equation. I mean, I'm always concerned about this, you know. And I'm concerned about being able to walk away. If I, you know, there I am in the middle of the night, I'm just in the wrong area. Is it the wrong area that makes me subject to this circumstance?
Well, it's also the fact that you've been sitting, five people have been sitting in the car for 10 minutes at midnight.
I want to get that. So if I'm in the wrong area and sitting in the car for 5 minutes, anything else that's involved here?
Well, the officer thought that was in this area, and in the light of the reports of the drug use, if every other fact is identical, yes, because
I can't walk away. If I'm in the wrong area and sitting in my car for 5 minutes, I can't walk away when the officer says stop.
Well, okay. Under my argument with the officer of reasonable suspicion, that's correct, because he has lawful authority to tell you to stop. Now, you know, he's acting on reasonable suspicion. Reasonable suspicion basically is based on innocent conduct, because if it wasn't innocent, it would provide evidence of a crime. If you had evidence of a crime, you have more than reasonable suspicion. And this court has said many times conduct can be innocent. I mean, there could be innocent conduct can still contribute to reasonable suspicion just because of all the other circumstances that go with it. And the idea of the detention is for the officer to ask questions to clarify whether it's entirely innocent or whether there's something more to it.
Counsel, are you done with Justice Bradley as far
yes.
as? If a person had broken out into a run, and I think Justice Bradley is talking about simply walking away. The facts of this case, just so I know the facts, that he either quickened his pace or he broke out into a run. That was the facts. Now,
yeah.
Is that where you're saying the obstruction happened the minute he got out of the car, or did it happen when he broke into a run?
Well, I think it's after the officer stopped him back in the car and he didn't comply with that. He didn't stay there. And he left the scene. That constituted the obstruction. Now,
are we looking at totality here on what really happened? I mean, you've heard several hypotheticals from all of us here. But what happened here, he got out, there was like I don't hear you, and then there was ended up with a run toward the house on the side of the street, right?
Right.
But the running has nothing to do with the obstruction charge under your analysis, as I understand it.
Right. Whether he walked or ran.
Am I correct?
No, I think that's correct. Whether he walked or ran, it would still be obstruction, but the fact he didn't comply with the order to stay. The difference between walking and running becomes important in terms of determining, contributing to reasonable suspicion. Running, flight, under Hodari and Wardlaw is reasonable suspicion. Walking would be much more ambiguous than, I can't even think of what it might be, but there's cases that indicate there might be circumstances.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Askins.
Thank you. Whether this court adopts the position that I'm advancing today or not, I would urge the court to address the Wisconsin constitutional question. And the reason I say that is that the Wisconsin Constitution, I think, is, as this court's last term shows, stands on its own, and I would urge the court to not abdicate the analysis completely to the U.S. Supreme Court. And so I would just ask that the court address the Wisconsin Constitution in this context.
Counsel, in that respect, I think that at least the majority of the court felt that there were strong policy reasons to move in that direction mm-hmm. last term in two of the cases.
Mm-hmm.
What would be the policy reasons here for not following the lead of the United States Constitution? In Dubose, I believe there was a real question of guilt or innocence. And then, Matt, you had a deliberate disregard of a Miranda warning. What's the distinction here that would justify going in a different direction?
There, let me list why I think Hodari is wrong and why I think this court should depart from it. It isolates from constitutional scrutiny the initial stages of contact between the police and the citizen. It shifts scrutiny from police action to the reaction of the citizen. It fails to recognize that pursuit constitutes a substantial interference with personal security that warrants constitutional protection. I think the virtue of the Mendenhall test is that it calls for the consistent application from one police encounter to the next, and which permits the police to determine in advance whether what their conduct that they contemplate will implicate either the Fourth Amendment or the Wisconsin Constitution.
What about Mr. Kleinmeier's argument that Hobson stresses different policy interests, that you really don't want to have citizens fighting with or running from the police and escalating the situation?
Except we have to remember, of course, that the Fourth Amendment and the Article 1, Section 11 regulates police conduct. It does not regulate the conduct of the citizenry. The focus of this amendment, the focus of this provision, is on what the government can do to Justice Bradley and her nephew sitting in the car talking about the Packers. That's the focus. And I, in light of Knapp, I went back and looked at Hoyer, because, of course, we think about the exclusionary rule and its value. And traditionally, the exclusionary rule is designed to discourage police misconduct. Well, as Lefebvre points out, one of the dangers, perhaps, of Hodari, that decision, is that this will encourage police to try to provoke flight in order to suddenly then have reasonable suspicion. And my position is that the better practice is to train police officers to have that body of knowledge, that those factors in mind when he or she decides to effect the seizure. And the other thing that Hoyer talks about. Oh, I'm sorry.
So as I understand it now, this is an open invitation that this court should uphold the Wisconsin Constitution. Forget about the last number of years.
No.
Just,
okay.
But I'm looking at this case, these facts, and Justice Butler's question as far as how would one respond, and as I gather it, with the calling out, the show of authority, and or the running or the disregard, I think you'd run into more problems. You're saying that if I gather this under these facts, that the police had violated the Constitution, our Constitution, because they violated the citizens' rights. That's what you're saying. That
I believe the officer lacked reasonable suspicion. I don't think that five people sitting in a car for 10 minutes is reasonable suspicion. And even in an area with bars, and I would note that the evidence in this case was that this is an area with bars, not high-crime neighborhood. So
I can follow up Justice Wilcox's questions, Chief, if that's all right. Assume that for purposes of the question that the court might agree with you that there was no reasonable suspicion at the point when the officer shined the spotlight in the vehicle. Is there anything inappropriate or illegal about the police going up and talking to the individuals in the vehicle?
No, as I mentioned, I think, to Justice Prosser earlier, I think what the officer could lawfully have done is leave the car, forget about the flashing lights and all of that, and take a walk, and walk up to the car and see what's going on. I think that would have been a lawful exercise of the police power at that point.
Where would the officer have parked?
He might have gotten a ticket.
I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, it was a crowded area, but the focus being that it's those lights that seem to me, and again, I know we've gotten into a discussion about which exactly the lights were that were on, and I would hope that, well, if that ultimately is the turning fact, then it seems to me that this would actually have to be remanded for a determination of what lights were flashing, because all we know is there were some lights. But I think that this focus on, well, did Charles Young even know the lights were on, what have you, that turns it into more of a subjective kind of analysis that the court ought to stay away from. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Askins, and thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier, for your arguments in another search and seizure case. That concludes 03AP2968CR, State versus Young. The court is in recess until 1:30 when it will hear its third case. The students should remain, and Justice Wilcox will be out shortly.